Reuters is reporting that the most famous of the Egyptian pro-democracy activists, Ahmed Duma, was sentenced in 3 years in prison on Tuesday after he accused the judge of bias and denounced his trial on charges of violence against the state as political. Duma was the leading figure in the 2011 uosrising that toppled Hosni Mubarak at the height of the, in quote, Arab Spring. He is accused of attacking the cabinet office building and security forces when clashes erupted during a sit-in there in 2011. I'm uncomfortable saying I told you so, but I told you so. When these protests erupted and were labeled the Arab Spring, I told everyone who would listen at the time that this was not a political movement. That America and the West and its media and politicians were completely misinterpreting what was occurring. And that those who were politically motivated were few and irrelevant. And that the real force operating in the Middle East was Islam. And that this was a demonstration of what I had witnessed over the preceding 10 years, that Islam was becoming more fundamentalist. I had noted that every time Muslims were given the opportunity to vote, that they elected the most fundamentalist candidates. They, in other words, capitulated to the threats of their imams, who told mostly illiterate individuals that you either side with the candidate that represents the most fundamentalist Islamic agenda, or that Allah would see to it that your soul was tortured forever in hell. And it became obvious that that was what was happening throughout the world of Islam, that it was becoming more fundamentalist, and that's bad, because that means more like Muhammad, and that's bad, because Muhammad was a pedophile. He was a rapist. He was a sexual pervert. He was a mass murderer. He was a ruthless terrorist. He was a thief. He was a slave trader, a kidnapper for ransom. There are very few individuals in all of human history as reprehensible as Muhammad. And yet the Quran, it tells good Muslims to follow his example. And so as Muslims become more fundamentalist, they become more like Muhammad, and that's really, really bad. And so when these protests erupted, first in Tunisia, then in Libya, then in Egypt, then in Iraq, and then in Syria, and then in Yemen, I told everyone who would listen that this has nothing to do with politics. That those that the media is focusing on who are freedom fighters are irrelevant. That what they are doing will actually be counterproductive to their cause. They will go from somewhat accepting, somewhat secular governments to fundamentalist Islamic governments that will rob them of their lives and their freedoms. Things are going to go bad, from bad to worse. And I didn't say it as, this is what I think might happen. I didn't say it as, this is a possibility we should be concerned about. I said, this is absolutely what is happening and will be the consequence of what is being unleashed on the world. I went beyond that and said that not only would those that the media was focusing on as the freedom-fighting darlings, like Ahmed Duma, who would be imprisoned who would have their lives snuffed out, but that this would cause an eradication of Christianity in the Islamic world and would ultimately lead to a unification of Islam and the imposition of fundamentalist Islamic regimes, the building of Islamic military capability, and then the ultimate attack on Israel. It was obvious. And that the United States would play a significant role in this process on the side of evil. All of it has happened exactly that way. The United States bombed the somewhat secular government of Muammar Gaddafi and has created a living hellhole. Libya is nothing now than bands of roaming terrorist mujahideen. Egypt is one of the most ruthless dictatorships in all the world. There are very few military juntas that are as draconian as we find in Egypt. And America is facilitating that because America pays the entire budget of the military that now dictates over Egypt. America is the cause of the Syrian war because of our invasion of Iraq and giving Iraq to Iran. America is the primary arms supplier to Muslims worldwide. Hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. We made this mess. It was inevitable. And now look at the result. And yet, even in the midst of this, even with the clear and comprehensive evaluation of what forces were actually working and what the consequence of this was going to be 3 years ago, and program after program devoted to explaining what's happening country by country, incident by incident, death by death. Even now, fewer than 1 in 1,000 people understand. Here, this Reuters journalist can't figure it out. Whatever happened? You know, they ousted the dictator. What did they get? The Muslim Brotherhood. They ousted the Muslim Brotherhood. What did they get? A military junta. And now with the military junta, what do they get? Death and incarceration to anyone who dares criticize them. This activist, Doma, shouted from his courtroom cage, which is how defendants are presented in the Egyptian system. That's another country I will never go to again. Ever. And by the way, there's nothing to see in Egypt that was built there post the Islamic invasions 1,300 years ago. Everything that worth seeing in Egypt preceded the Muslim onslaught. But I will never go again. He was shouting, down with military rule. The reason I share this with you is because that's what we have now in America. Is military rule. If you think that America has the largest military in the world, the largest spy apparatus in the world, larger combined than all other nations on earth combined, to deal with the Islamic State, then I'm telling you, you're living in a fog. The American military is to control Americans. That's why there's almost no differentiation today between federal agents and the military, between federal agents and local police. America has become a military state. They have the guns. They're authorized to kill. And they're doing it. The very thing that this man was protesting is happening here. And, of course, he correctly assessed that the court had trumped up charges against him, that he wasn't guilty of perpetrating a violent attack, that he wasn't in a genuine court where facts would be heard and good judgment would be exercised. No, it was a farce, just as its justice has become in America. It's a farce. He was there for political reasons. What was the politics? The military junta. He was there because the military junta wanted him silenced. And by the way, incarceration in an Egyptian jail is torture. They wanted his voice silenced. He was one of the few who was willing to stand up. And I'm telling you, folks, that since so few are willing to stand up, the way that the American government and the way that governments around the world are going to impose their military rule is they're going to deal savagely. They're going to deal severely. They're going to deal publicly with those who are willing to stand up. They will make an example of them, not unlike the Roman Catholic Church did with their heretics, with those who opposed them, with those who spoke out against them. They will make such a public display of those who would bow their back and say, no, I'm not going to surrender. No. That ultimately, since there are so few willing to do so, most of them will capitulate. And then, just as it is depicted in 1984 in Brave New World, an Animal Farm, the masses will be controlled. You will continue to lose everything. Everything. Access to accurate information. Freedom. Your wealth. Your dignity. Everything. It is what is happening here. It is what has already happened there. Scott told me during the break that one of my least favorite athletes, and I'm going to apologize up front if he was seriously injured. I don't think that is the case. But he was involved in an accident, was taken away from his vehicle, a truck, in on a stretcher. I call this particular athlete my least favorite because of the malfeasance that he represents and the blight that he puts on the NCAA. Cam Newton is the athlete. He is the quarterback of the Carolina football team, the NFL team. He was an SEC quarterback, first at Florida, where he was drummed out of school for a combination of bad behaviors, stealing, cheating, general bad behavior. And
Aaron Hernandez. Let's not forget
that. Yeah, this school. I know. Aaron Hernandez, who apparently committed a murder down there in Florida, and has absolutely committed murder since then. The school where Urban Meyer had at one time 30 convicts on his roster. They dropped this guy, Cam Newton. I mean, Cam Newton had to be really bad, or not very good, to get booted out of Florida. But his daddy still tried to sell him for $250,000 to the SEC school that would get him for a one-and-done to be the quarterback. And Auburn bit, he took Auburn to a national championship, a complete disgrace to the credibility of the NCAA. But, there's a thousand blights on the NCAA. He became a quarterback in the NFL and is now the quarterback having a horrible year, although he had a good game last week of the Carolina Panthers. Scott, what is the report on the accident?
It sounds like he just got an accident. He flipped his vehicle. He was driving some type of truck. And he flipped his vehicle, rolled it. It looks like he's okay. It sounds like he's going to be okay. No reports on if there's any injuries or anything like that.
What time did the accident occur?
About 12:30 Eastern. So a little right around an hour ago.
Okay. So during the day, wasn't out at night carousing at nightclubs that we know of.
Nope.
Probably.
He was actually on his way to practice, so.
Okay.
He was on his way to practice. They have a picture. There's pictures of him on the stretcher smiling, talking with the paramedics.
Maybe
so
he's okay.
He's okay.
I will tell you that I own three pickup trucks. And I also own three SUVs. And pickup trucks, my opinion, are not safe when driven at any rate of speed. They aren't safe because there's not enough weight on the back wheels. And the SUVs are typically not safe because there's too much weight up high. And they are extremely easy to roll an SUV. You know, if you turn sharply in an SUV at speed, you are really putting that yourself in harm's way. And with a pickup truck, typically the problems are if the road is wet or you have icy conditions, and in North Carolina it wouldn't have icy conditions, but it could be wet. Yeah, this is a big rainstorm. The East is being deluged again. It was an extraordinarily wet summer and wet again as we move in towards winter. They are dangerous. And, you know, if you are dodging, say, another car or person or critter out there, easy to flip. The next news story is that Sierra Leone has overtaking Liberia as the country with the highest number of Ebola cases. The World Health Organization is reporting. You know, Ebola was something we were talking about every day. And now it is something we talk about every other week. And it's interesting, of course, that the United States decided that it would send its troops over to Liberia. What, 3,000 of them to build hospitals. And the time that the our 3,000 troops had built the first 25-bed temporary hospital, the main hospitals in Liberia were already three-quarters empty. Liberia has run its course, or Ebola has run its course in Liberia. It ran its course in Liberia before America arrived to allegedly save the day. But it has not run its course in Sierra Leone. It continues to kill. We'll talk about how many have died there and in Sierra Leone and Liberia when Shattering Myths continues after the break. So now the numbers of cumulative number of cases since the start of the outbreak in March, now what, 9 months ago, stands at 7,780 in Sierra Leone and 7,719 in Liberia. Almost 16,000 people between them. The figure in Guinea is 2,283. So of those infected, you've got between those three countries, 18,000 individuals. The virus has killed more than 6,300 people in those three countries. You know, it's amazing that 6,300 people and the world was upside down. It's just upside down. You know, 6,300 people, a lot of people die. Sad. It's a horrible way to die, Ebola. And the reason Ebola is just so terrible is that family members typically come to the aid of other family members, and then they get it, and so it wipes out entire families. A horrible disease. But 6,300 people. I mean, that's nothing compared to the number of people that flu kills every year. Nothing compared to the number of people pneumonia kills every year. It's nothing compared to the number of people malaria kills every year. It's nothing compared to the number of people killed in traffic accidents every year. It's nothing compared to the number of people cigarettes kill every year. It's nothing compared to the number of people that alcohol kills every year. It's nothing compared to the number of people killed because they chose to consume recreational drugs. It's nothing compared to the number of people killed by Islam each year. And yet it preoccupied the world. We even have an Ebola czar in the United States. Talk about stupid. Well, the World Health Organization, which has been out to lunch on this whole thing. I mean, it was the World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control that were talking about a million cases of Ebola by January. A million! What are we at, 18,000? I mean, to get from 18,000 in mid-December to a million in January, do you think that these buffoons were lost in space? Do you think they were just throwing out numbers, hoping that the world would unleash enormous amounts of money, give them more power, more control, enrich them? Stupid. The U.S. coalition fighting the Islamic State has pledged to send an additional 1,500 troops to Iraq, a top U.S. commander said. Lieutenant James Terry, who is coordinating efforts against the Islamic State, said the soldiers would be in addition to the 3,100 soldiers already deployed and promised. 4,600. And that's in addition to the many hundreds at the U.S. Embassy and the 5,000 U.S. staff at the U.S. Embassy, many of whom are with the CIA and our military. How many do you have before you can no longer say we don't have boots on the ground? Are all of these going to be levitating units? Of course, he did not say which coalition members would provide the extra troops or what role they would play, because they're all coming from America. Coalition members discussed the Islamic State issue and made the troop pledge at a security conference in the region last week. It is hoped that the deployment of additional soldiers will increase the effectiveness of the Iraqi army, much of which proved ineffective under an Islamic onslaught. Let's see. In Vietnam, what did we do? We said, we're going, because we were failing, we're winning every battle and losing the war. We lost our ability to lie and deceive the American people and the world as to why we were there. Gulf of Tonkin incident didn't occur. It was a lie. Our reason for invading. And once we were there, we deposed the Vietnamese government and set up one of our own liking. Turned out to be more corrupt than the one that we deposed. Killed a lot of people. Had a lot of our own people killed. Squandered a lot of money, making a bad situation worse. And after a while, we decided, well, I can't win this sucker. So why don't we turn the battle over to the Vietnamese? We'll call it Vietnamization. Yeah, it was Tricky Dick's title. And we'll train them, we'll equip them to defend themselves, just like we did in Iraq. Didn't work in Vietnam, did it? Why did we think it was going to work in Iraq? All it turned out in Iraq is to empower Shia Muslims to terrorize Sunni Muslims. That's all it did. And then when the Sunni Muslims responded, they became the Islamic State. Oops. Didn't work out very well. In fact, it worked out poorer for us in Iraq than it did for us in Vietnam, because in Vietnam, all that happened was that the foe simply overran the army that we had paid billions of dollars to equip. But in the case of Iraq, the army that we paid billions of dollars equipped simply surrendered their weapons to the Sunnis in a religious war, and it started a religious civil war that has now engulfed the Middle East. Oh, boy. Not so good. In fact, horribly bad. And now, not recognizing that it was our training and our invasion and our weaponizing of what was simply a religious divide between Sunni and Shias, where we're on one side in one country, on the other side in the other country, next door, making a bad situation worse in all three countries, that we now think that the solution to the problem is the very thing that caused the problem. A fresh invasion of American troops. Wow. Can't call us smart. I had a conversation a week or so ago with one of my favorite people, Kirk. I think he's one of everyone's favorite people on this program. Kirk calls in fairly regularly. And Kirk called in on behalf of his wife, Terry. And he said that Terry came to the conclusion that God helps those who don't even know him yet. And we talked about it for some time, and it generated a host of emails to me. One of these emails, though, was particularly interesting, and it was written by another one of our favorite people, William the Elevator Man, who calls this program and the Shabbat program that we do on Blog Talk Radio. William is extraordinary, one of my very favorite people on earth. And the conclusion that Terry, Kirk, and I came to, and we were comfortable and yet uncomfortable in this, because it was our perception. It was our own personal experience. It was our just broad survey of Yah's testimony that caused us to come to the conclusion that since Yahweh is not constrained by time as we are, and therefore knows who's going to choose to engage in a relationship with him, that he has an incentive to make certain that those individuals survive and are positioned such that they can make that choice. And that, you know, there's examples. For example, Abraham. When Yahweh first approached Abraham, Abraham did not know him. And yet, he invited Abraham to engage in a relationship with him. When Yahweh first approached Moshe, Moshe did not know him. He had to introduce himself to Moshe. Moshe initially was reluctant. And so, before Moshe knew Yahweh, Yahweh reached out to Moshe. There are a number of very important examples like this in my own life, as it was the case with Terry and with Kirk. All of us had episodes in our lives where we were convinced, certainly we believed, that Yahweh had played a role in our lives, had spoken to us, had invited us to engage with him before we knew it. I told the story of how I was ticketed on a flight that became the victim of the first act of Islamic airborne terrorism. 77 people aboard an aircraft that Abu Nidal bombed, and that it was having contracted malaria in Zimbabwe, today's Zimbabwe, yesterday's Rhodesia, that I became too ill to make the connection, and so I was not on that flight due to contracting malaria. And I'd been on the flight, I'd been dead. And I always thought, you know, there might be some God's hand in that. And then when it became time to let Americans know why 19 Muslims screaming Allahu Akbar, flew planes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and intended to fly another into either the Capitol or the White House. Why they were doing so. And God clearly wanted Islam exposed and condemned. And the story, the analysis of what motivated people to act so heinously, particularly because it is the religion that is most focused on destroying Israel, as well as Yehudim, the chosen people. I felt God's call. We had a conversation. At that point, I did not know him. But it was through that process that I came to know him. And so, this friend, this is a long way to get to this response, but William sent me a letter and said, you know, I think there's a statement in Yeshaya, Isaiah, that affirms what you've been saying. All right, so that's been a long story. That's my my style is to make short stories long. But here is the line that William shared from the prophets. It's from the longest of the prophetic books, Yeshaya, that pertains to the discussion that Kirk and I were having as to whether or not Yahweh engages on behalf of those who do not yet know him when he realizes, because he is not stuck in the ordinary flow of time, that such individuals will eventually choose to know him and to engage in the covenant. And therefore, does engage on behalf of those individuals before they know him. And this whole concept also gets around the idea of, is it appropriate for God to play favors? Now, I want to tell you, I always get jittery when I say it's something appropriate for God to do, because, you know, it is his universe, and he can do anything he darn well wants to do. He authored life. We exist because of him. But he has put us in a position where he doesn't mind if we question him, so long as we do so respectfully. And he has also put himself in a position where he has said, you know, I am reliable. I am dependable. My words never change. I'm going to do exactly as I promised. And he has identified his characteristic, his traits, and his promises. And so he can't welch on them. Now, if there's a place of separation, God can't go there. If God has said, if you engage in the covenant, that you're going to be immortal, you're going to be perfected, you're going to be adopted, you're going to be empowered and enriched, you can count on it. He cannot welch on that deal. So I say with some concern, is it appropriate for God to play favorites? Is it fair, if you will, that God approached me and didn't approach my neighbor? Now, personally, I think it is. Of course, I'm a beneficiary. What do you expect from me? I think it is, though, because of the fact that Yahweh knew yesterday and 1,000 yesterdays ago that he and I would engage in a relationship. He did not choose to reach out to me because for any other reason, in my view, than he knew that eventually I would come to know him, respect him, and accept what he was offering. And that I did so my own free will. I invested my time. I made my own decision. And because of that, he knew that in advance of me doing so. So it seems to be entirely appropriate. But beyond that, if the purpose of creating this universe is as it is presented in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, which is to create a being capable of exercising free will, capable of making sound decisions based on the observation of quality information, so that those individuals could come to know and engage in a relationship with the universe's creator. Because without such loving and caring familial relationships, the creator of the universe cannot be infinite, cannot continue to grow. And that the creator's intent was to enjoy the creation of a second universe for the express purpose of sharing it with us. That under those circumstances, since that is his plan, that is his intent, why is it, would anyone think it to be inappropriate for him to choose those he wishes to spend eternity with? I chose my wife. Now, it's true, I did not choose my children, but I did have an influence over them. But why can't Yahweh choose to reach out to? That doesn't mean that Yahweh never hit me over the head and said, I like, and therefore, you're going to capitulate. No, it was very subtle. Maybe saving me here and there from what otherwise might have been catastrophic so that I could get to the point where I invested the time to make this decision. I did it late in life. So here's the line. I am Yahweh. There is none besides me. And there are no gods besides me. I will help you, even though you do not know me. I will help you, even though you do not know me. He can. He has. He will. We'll be back.